It's a good question. The question is, his father grew up in a somewhat repressive Christian environment, and how do you open him up again? The way that I use most often is finding some good novels, if they'll read novels. Now, the novel that has had the most impact on me in the last few years, any question, is one by a man called Michael O'Brien, and it's called Island of the World. It's about this sick. But it is an astonishing novel. If it doesn't reduce you to prayer and tears, I would be very surprised. But he doesn't preach. So Michael O'Brien, Ignatius Press, Island of the World. It's set in the Balkans after the Second World War, and it opens. You see a little boy of 8 being sent with a message, and then you follow his life through all sorts of amazing disasters that he conquers in some way. My wife doesn't normally read novels, and I read this one. I said, Sally, you might read this one. She couldn't put it down. And shortly afterwards, I was speaking at a dude ranch in Colorado in the summer. I get to do that every now and again because doctors organize it. If I give some lectures, they can get CME credits and write it off tax. So, you know, I'm a good deal. And we got there, and we were a bit early, and we checked in and went to get a coffee, and two friends that we'd known before for some years were both there. And we sat down, and all four of us had read that book in the previous few months, and all four had been reduced to tears and prayer. And I remember there's a pediatrician in Jamaica, a Brethren lady, who's a very Brethren lady, a single woman, and I caught her reading trashy Christian romances, and I said, Kay, you can do better than that. And she said, like what? So I gave her Michael O'Brien. And a month or so later, I got an email which said, I'm getting towards the end of this book, and I'm slowing down because I don't know what I'm going to do when I get to the end of it. But I promise you, I will never read another double space slushy Christian romance in my life. So we moved her on. So that would work, but it's a long book. Another one that might work is Walker Percy's Lost in the Cosmos. It's called The Last Self-Help Book. This is the other end of the spectrum in that you can do it in short bits. And he trained as a psychiatrist and then got tuberculosis and wrote a prize-winning book, The Moviegoer, while he was in the sanatorium, because this was pre-drugs. But this book is a self-help book. So he has a little scenario, and then he asks you questions, and he dumps you in the existential mud up to your neck. So the one that comes to mind is short and easy, and you can relate to it. He says, I want you to imagine that you're married to a guy who's taken early retirement. He sits in front of the sports channel and drinks 2 6-packs a day. He wants to go to Vegas and play the machines. You want to go to Europe and look at the churches and museums. You're not exactly happy. And you go out for the weekly shop in Florida. And on your way back, you hear on the radio that another house in your development has disappeared into a sink pot. You don't catch the details, but as you drive into your street, you realize it's your house. Are you A, mortified, or B, relieved? After all, 25 years with George was enough for anyone. And he's got you in all the human ambiguities and ambivalences in 30 seconds. And then he makes you think about it. He has another lovely one in which he has, I think it's Calvin, Luther, and some atheists turn off at a talk show. It's hilarious. So he doesn't preach, but the story has always got that existential aspect to it. The other person who doesn't preach, who's can move people along in that context, I think is Wendell Berry. And he's written the imagined history of a place in Kentucky over the whole of the last century. And it starts in the days of horse and buggy and one-room schoolrooms and comes all the way up to close to modern. He's my age. He got tenure in English in a major university, I forget which one, and then realized the university was losing its way long ago and threw it away. Went back to Kentucky to grow tobacco like his grandfather and his father, write essays and poems, and novels. And he doesn't preach, but he knows that the world without faith is empty. And so he writes warts and all stories. Now, you're in medical school, right? No, you're at VTech. Because in the middle of that book, there's a story set in a more intensive than one of his books, a more intensive than careful unit, which is just a brilliant account of the difference between the reductive modern world and the richer, older world that rural people still inhabit to a rapidly diminishing degree. So he captures that sort of angst for the past or vague longing for it. The reason we all like Tolkien in the last 50 years, it's the same thing, isn't it? That he's painting the picture of a world that is not disenchanted, but the world that you're being presented with left, right, and center is disenchanted. But that's not the truth. My favorite line in poetry about Christianity is from Gerard Manley Hopkins, where he says, "Christ plays in 10,000 places, lovely in limbs and lovely in eyes, not his, to the Father through the features of men's faces." It's beautiful. I think of it every time I watch my grandchildren playing, you know, and I think God thinks about us something like that. It's true. That the moment you can touch those chords, you get through to people. Dealing with people who are seriously injured, your Father's going to need to touch the chords, and deep down he knows that. You're looking for the literature that will help him to cross that barrier. The last thing he wants is a preacher at this stage. But that's why narrative is so good. As Tolkien said, fairy tales are truer than the newspaper. And he's right. But we need to be more sophisticated readers. We're not. I mean, particularly as evangelicals, we need to learn that. I mean, when I'm traveling, if I go, well, I'm probably far enough south, let me test. How many of you go to churches where there are people who believe the Bible is literally true? Quite a few. But of course they don't, do they? They only think they do. When Jesus says, "I am the door," none of them go looking for a handle. They recognize that's a metaphor. And the only way we can talk to one another is with metaphors. So they at least recognize metaphors. But on the other hand, when Mark says they sat down on the grass and it was green in his description of the feeding of the 5,000, what's the significance of that? What does it tell you? Well, I think it tells you that Mark was there. The grass is not green for long in Israel each year. So I can imagine him leaning back in his chair and saying, "I've got to write about the feeding of the 5,000. He writes down, they sat down on the grass and it was green, because he saw it in his mind's eye. This is reportage. This is somebody who was on the scene. Now, I read a story to you that began once upon a time in the land of Uz. What kind of story would that be? It would be a fairy tale, right? It's also the opening of the book of Job in Tolkien's translation. Because it was Uz, not Oz, that I said. Now, who knows more about the kind of literature he's reading, you or Tolkien? It's Tolkien, isn't it? And the first thing, the Bible is one book with innumerable genres of literature. And if you don't recognize the genre of literature you're reading, you're going to make some serious mistakes of interpretation. I mean, the verse that got the church into trouble with Galileo was from the Psalms. "The earth is fixed and shall not be moved forever." Now, if you use a poetry book to determine what physics is about, you're going to be in trouble. And the church eventually recognized that and repented. Clearly, Job is a play, isn't it? I mean, it's put on nowadays as a play. It was written as a play. I've no doubt there was a historical Job, but I do not think that anybody covered from head to foot in boils sat down and had long philosophical conversations such as are recorded in Job at that point. That came when the boils had subsided somewhat. But it's an incredible story about man's relationship with God in terms of suffering and what's actually required, and that it ends in repentance is extraordinary. And it should be read that way. And the reason I go through these sequences, particularly a bit further south, some people listening to me think that I'm a liberal. Now, they don't know what they mean by a liberal when they say that. They're much more liberal than I am, but they don't know it. And reading in a wooden fashion is one way of getting yourself in deep trouble, being very reductionist. Genesis 1 is a very good example. It can be read with imagination and with, what should I say, real skill. And it comes to life in ways that you don't realize till someone shows you. The most intriguing book on Genesis I've read in the last few years is by Leon Cass. A book called, can you remember the title, Ross? Reading Genesis for Wisdom? The Beginning of Wisdom, that's right, yeah. Absolutely superb book. Now, Leon Cass was George Bush's choice for the head of his ethics committee on Capitol Hill. A Jewish guy, a biochemist and a philosopher. But the book is generated from a course he taught in the University of Chicago, for which the only prerequisite was that you had to be fluent in Hebrew. And unlike many professors, he gives credit to the students who contributed to the book all the way through. But just to indicate to you just how dumb we are in our reading, this applies to me as well. He asked the question, I think, on page 1 or 2, and I had never thought about it. There are two things, two acts of creation that don't get the personal accolade that they are good. What are they? Yeah. What are the things, though? The heavens, yeah. What's the other one? He knows his Bible very well, you see, but if I'd seen him there, I would have told him not to answer the question because I would have guessed that he would. How many of you knew that? That the heavens are not said to be good. The other one is us. We don't get a personal accolade. The whole creation does, but not those two. And Cass's comment on that is the Jewish one, which is very interesting and I think probably absolutely true. All the nations around Israel believed they had creation stories and they all began with copulation in the heavens. So they regarded the heavens as sacred. So God told the Jews, no, they're not, they're just something I made. So he purposely left the most sacred thing for all their neighbors, and he doesn't even say it was good. He rubs it in by saying, and the stars also. And they could see millions of them. I mean, there were no electric light to hide it. And they've been thinking about their scriptures for 3,000 years longer than we have. So it's always worth looking at what they thought. And us? Well, the Holy Trinity knew what they'd done when they started us. It was trouble, but with a worthwhile outcome at the end, in God's sight anyway. A love story of extraordinary proportions. Now, isn't that a more creative way to read it than the way you've done it so far? It is. And it makes more sense, and it makes you think more, it makes you think about God more, and what God implants for us. I mean, there are some people in your churches who would be offended by the statement that there are two stories there, two creation stories, and they don't fit together. And that's because the ancient world didn't bother about it fitting together. Doing jigsaw puzzles is something we do. And we want all the bits to fit together with no loose ends, right? But that isn't what happens anywhere else in the world. And that only happened after the Enlightenment. What was the first question ancient people asked about stories? Not how do they fit together, but what? What are they for? Teleology. What is the purpose of this story? And you know, the purpose of the first story is extraordinary. Adam doesn't even say a word. I mean, it's a real put down for human beings. God made them. He didn't say we were good and we didn't even speak. That's all in the second story. It's the woman who speaks first, really. And that hasn't stopped since, has it? You know. But it's much more exciting to read it that way and to ask, what is God trying to teach us? Purpose, the thing that got chopped out at the Enlightenment, teleology that you seem not to know about. The Bible is a teleological book. It's written on purpose, for particular purposes. And they're not even fixed over time, are they? The same text can have different meanings at different places, which is amazing. I once heard a superb lecture, and you should have this guy come down here if you can get him, when if the college gets going. How many of you have ever heard Jeremy Begbie teach? Any of you? Just Mark at the back. And yes, Joy, of course. Mark, you must get him here, because you know he's at Duke now. He was Cambridge and Edinburgh, but he's at Duke. And his, we had him at Augustine College in Ottawa, and he did a wonderful three-day session with us on the sound of hope from music. And he began by playing a bit of Mozart. His condition for the visit was that we have a very good grand piano available. So we did that. And he stopped one chord before the end. And then he looked up and said, "Now, every one of you in this room knew that that piece is not finished." He said, if Mozart was two floors up and asleep, he'd come down to play, bang, and he plays the last chord. "Now it's finished," he said. "You can all hear that. So don't tell me you can't hear music. You all can." And then he pointed out that music in the Western tradition is a home away again and home again. Home away and home again. The Garden of Eden, the world, heaven. But it's also Israel, Egypt, Israel. In other words, there's little home away, home again, inside a big home away, home again, inside many others. And so the same story functions in different ways in different places, and he shows you how that works. It was an extraordinary set of talks that changed my listening to music, and he's eclectic. He goes all the way from pop songs to modern classical music, and can make you see what it's about. And he's only a few miles away, really, from you. One state, is it, in North Carolina? Yeah. So someone to think about, you might get down here at some time and have him, along with, there's another guy up there, runs a program in theology and medicine. I know the guy well, and name has gone from me at the moment, but Far Colon, yeah. He was a Western lecturer at Ottawa last year. I first met him more than 20 years ago when he was a resident, and we had a long conversation in a coffee shop, and he asked me, "Okay, I'm ready to start my career. I could do internal medicine. What else should I think about? What's going to matter for the Christian community over the next few years?" And I said to him, "Well, I've been grandfathered in to talking about medical ethics, but they're not going to be any more grandfathering. The bioethicists want to rule the roost. We need Christians in there. Have you got the fortitude to write dull but undeniable papers for a few years to get established?" He's done it. And we had him come and talk to us last year about euthanasia, and he did it brilliantly. You can hear it on the college website if you want to. And again, he's not far away from you. We've got lots of really good scholars out there. And that's the other way. What does your father read? What does he like?
He watches a lot of political talk shows.
He likes a lot of political stuff.
Yeah. Very involved in politics.
Oh.
He watches a lot of TV.
Well, another person that I would use is Leslie Newbegin on tacit knowledge. But yeah, and look at those papers from First Things, because it's a public policy journal. Any other questions? Yes. Non-maleficence. Doing non-maleficence, not doing evil. So the Ten Commandments are the thou shalt nots. You can extrapolate to the goods. Then you have a framework for justice. Only then is autonomy safe. I didn't get to that point. I should have done. Autonomy without a framework of justice is called anarchy. And that's where we are in the university at the moment, because they've inverted the whole scheme, and autonomy trumps everything else. But it can't. It's utterly irrational. You only have to think of driving home tonight autonomously. You wouldn't get home if everybody did it. What we do in all societies is we trade in autonomy for the goods of freedom. Oh, sorry, yes. Loud and clear, please, because I had trouble first time around.
Sorry about that. Connections between the Magna Carta and Scripture.
Well, it's a good question. The question is, what are the connections between Magna Carta and freedom? Now, what was one of the first things that the kings had to do in Deuteronomy? They had a duty. What was it? Yeah. Yeah, they had to write it down, didn't they? Write it down, yeah. So in other words, right from the beginning, God told them, if you have kings, you will lose on the deal. You're better off without them. But they must write the law down. The king has to be under some authority. Now, in the time of Magna Carta, we still had some control over kings because they feared excommunication. Now they don't. That's why they're so much more dangerous. And I don't mean just kings, I mean politicians and the like. When your rulers do not fear God, it's time to start fearing your rulers. On purely rational grounds, it's got nothing to do with religion, this is just straight common sense. If they believe they'll be judged after death, you can trust them more than if they don't, rationally. And so Magna Carta occurred at a time when there was a bad king, and he was fighting with the Pope. And that didn't go well down well with the people, because the Pope denied the whole of the British people the right to the Eucharist. They did not like that. In the end, he had to give in, and he had to sign. He didn't want to, but he did. And so it was a major step forward. My good friend John Robson, I mentioned earlier in the sessions, he's made a video about Magna Carta because he thinks it's being neglected. But there are a lot of people on the right in politics who know that it's part of your history too. We'd be much better off with common law than we are with codified law. Yes. Yeah, you said freaked. Is that a modern slang use of the word?
Intrigued.
I heard it as freaked, which really freaked me out for a moment. Yeah. Well, the really interesting thing about it, if you can start a reading group, it will go on if it's got a real base. Over the years, I started reading groups indirectly all over the world. And they go on, dozens of them, have been going for 20 years or more. Because once people get into the habit of reading decent books, and the important thing is to find some people you can trust. I never read unrecommended books. Why would I? I have friends whose job it is to read books, so when I need another one, I say, who should I read? I don't waste my time reading one that isn't worth reading. So the ones that I recommend have been recommended to me by someone else. If you look at my book list, it says at the top, these are books I've actually enjoyed as opposed to ones I'm supposed to have enjoyed. And it includes the enemy. You need to know your enemy. So serious reading groups really help. What I would suggest you start in college is something very easy to do. It would be Peter Crave's The Best Things in Life by IVP. And just read the last chapter of that book together. It's written as a dialogue between Socrates and a student. And Socrates takes her world apart without making a statement. That's his skill. After Jesus, the world's greatest questioner. And you've got to learn to ask questions. And you learn to ask questions by seeing other people's clever questions. And as you do it, you get better at it yourself. Don't make statements. Ask questions. Yes.
I have a mic here if somebody wants to ask their question more loudly.
He's got a voice that would reach the other end of the room if he's in the mood. Yeah. 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 Yeah, there's quite a few books along those lines. Another one, Much Depends Upon Dinner. Yeah, the woman, yeah, I've forgotten her. So it's something we need to get back to. A lot of our problems would disappear if we had meals together. Families in particular need to take this a firm hand in this. My wife, as usual, understood these things intuitively before I got to them sort of theoretically. So when we arrived in Canada in 1980, our children were 5, 7, 9, 11. And we'd been briefly in England between Jamaica and coming to Canada. And I said to the children, the televisions here have innumerable programs, none of which appear to me to be worth watching, but what do you want to do? And bless them, they said, well, in Jamaica, we never had television, it wasn't worth watching there. They said, we read more books and we played more games. It was better. We don't need a television. So we never had one. What was really intriguing was that my oldest daughter is very sociable. She's the one who's now a missionary in Malawi. She said she could go to school and talk about the soap operas without ever having seen them. They were so predictable. No problem. So my wife said, we are not going to let the family fall apart. And the first thing, she wouldn't have a microwave. And she developed a cuisine, which was lovely when it came out of the oven, but didn't heat up that well. That's what she was after. She didn't want the children saying, oh, I'll eat it later. Because A, she wasn't going to let them do that. But B, she wanted to make it so they didn't want to do that. Because the food was good when it came out of the oven, but it didn't heat up well. And everybody had to be there. And of course, quite soon, your children begin to get stroppy in various ways, particularly my second daughter is very capable of stopping anything she wanted to. So she effectively stopped family prayers. She could disrupt them. And you don't want to go on in the face of opposition in the family. You've got to get around that. And it's father's job to listen and find out what's bothering the kids. And then use scripture without saying that it's scripture, although they soon learn to play the game, to get at that question. And they engage in that. So all my children have said to me that their most important education occurred at the dining room table. It's got to be a place where conversation happens. A meal should last about an hour. If there aren't books on the table at the end of it, you've failed. That makes all the difference in the world, and you must be honest. You must tell the truth, and the rest will follow. Yeah. Yeah. The question is, you missed the talk on sexuality. Yes, apart from Janet Smith, it's amazing that Janet Smith and John Paul have written the best books on sexuality, and don't read John Paul because he's too long, but there is, what's the name of the guy? But you go to any Catholic bookshop and you'll see John Paul's Theology of the Body, yeah?
Christopher West.
That's right, yeah, Christopher West. They've been thinking about it a lot, well, 1,500 years longer than we have, so it's not altogether surprising that they have some worthwhile insights. See, we came into being at a time as reductionism had happened. So Catholic theology happened before reductionism happened. So it emphasizes the mystery of God. There was little control over nature. There was little literacy, and the printing press had not been invented. That has an impact on theology. Theology is man's attempt to control God, isn't it, to a large degree? And of course, we can't put God in a theological box. It will always break at some point. Whereas Protestant theology was written just after or around the period when Copernicus, Galileo, Kepler, and Newton had given us a mechanical model of the cosmos. So our theology tended to be too rigid. We wanted to do it like the scientists were doing it and dot every I and cross every T. You can't do that. God can't be put in boxes. He says, my ways are not your ways, neither are my thoughts your thoughts. I'm higher than you are. Now, that's not making theology unimportant, but it means you have to be aware that it is always under review. That's why my favorite current theologian to read would be N.T. Wright. I think he's the most thoughtful theologian alive today. And if you've never read The Challenge of Jesus or Surprised by Hope, they're books you can give to anyone. And he said he's been amazed at the correspondence he's had from Surprised by Hope. He's incredibly smart. I think he's got 3 PhDs. And the amount that he's written, it's almost at the level of Luther, who had no competition. Yeah. But apparently we must stop, because I think Jenny is going to want to talk to us in a minute.